no crying in baseball.
You're 5 feet nothing, 100 and nothing, and you got hardly a speck of athletic ability. And you hung in with the best college football team in the land for 2 years.
Fuck you, Joe. I do it myself.
In here, there were two guys killing each other. But I guess that's better than 20 million. But what I'm trying to say is that if I can change, and you can change, everybody can change.
Welcome to Montucky Skies. I'm Biggs.
I'm Brandon.
And I'm executive producer Vince Gilligan.
Ah, we're going to go right out of the gate talking about Better Call Saul.
Isn't it good to have the phrase executive producer Vince Gilligan back in your life at the end of an episode?
Yeah,
I think the last time I had that was either the end of Breaking Bad or the Community episode.
He did a Community episode?
Yes, he did. It was wonderful.
It's really good.
Yeah, he directed the whole thing. I think he wrote the episode.
Dan Harmon wrote the episode.
Did he?
This is the thing about Dan Harmon. He's only credited on like 4 episodes in the show's run, but everybody in that writer's room says Dan Harmon writes every single script.
And
just
it was
not the ones that he wasn't there for, though, right?
Right, not the ones he was, not that season, but the ones he's been around for.
How was that season, by the way?
I enjoyed it. It tried too hard to be Dan Harmon Community, and I feel like they would have been better off just embracing it and being their own thing. But
which season was that?
Season 4.
Okay.
Yeah, because I know he got booted off the
show. There's good episodes within it and a lot of great moments within it, but it doesn't tie together. It doesn't feel as unified as the Harmon stuff does. It's very clearly not a part of the same vision, and they wanted to try to force it to be a part of that vision, and it just didn't work.
So it wasn't the rug that tied the room together?
No. Still a funny season, though. Like, there's still good stuff in it. It's just, you do have to step back and take it for what it is.
Yeah. So, Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about this.
Better Call Jimmy
bit.
McGill.
If you haven't watched it, maybe, I don't know how much we're going to reference it. Maybe put down the podcast.
Come back to us.
Torn it, whatever you got to do. Because there's a new episode tonight after this show airs.
That's
tonight.
Right.
So, they're doing back-to-back episodes, but I fucking love this episode.
It was really, really, really good.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was exactly what I hoped it would be once I realized they were doing an hour-long drama, which was like a drama with a lot of funny stuff.
Yeah, it's Breaking Bad flavored, but you can tell they want this to be its own show, to exist on its own.
Yeah, so Bob Odenkirk, I'm so happy for.
Me too.
I am so happy. Ever since I saw him screaming on Mr. Show for the first time, I knew I had a man crush on him. And it's great seeing him do what he's great at.
He's finally getting to be the leading man.
Yeah, and he's a great screamer. He really is. Every time he screams, I love it. It doesn't have to be as Saul Goodman, which he does. He doesn't even have the name Saul Goodman at all in this episode.
At all, and
the only time he had Saul Goodman was when he was watching tapes of his old,
that's right,
commercials on TV, on VHS, on his flat screen TV.
So what I really did like was they gave the nod to the fans a couple of times in this, to Breaking Bad, but it's definitely its own beast. But let's talk about the Breaking Bad tie-ins really quick. So the first thing you see, which Zach pointed out, which is he's Breaking Bad, he says what?
He says something along the lines of, when they ask him what he's going to do now that it's all over, he says something along the lines of, I don't know, maybe I'll go to Nebraska and work a Cinnabon.
And that's exactly what he's doing.
And this I loved. So this opening sequence is shot entirely in black and white. And I don't know if it's an intentional homage to Nebraska, but because it's so specifically Nebraska and it is black and white,
the fact that
it came to my mind.
Yeah, the fact that it's in Nebraska, maybe it was a happy accident, but I really feel like they probably did that on purpose. That thought had occurred to me as well. which is hilarious. Have you seen Nebraska yet?
I have not.
Oh, it's really good. Bob Odenkirk has a very little part in it. He's good in it, but yeah, it's more Will Forte's
very much so. It's movie. His and Bruce Stern's.
And it's on Netflix, so you can check it out anytime you want, but it's really good. I enjoyed that movie.
It's very good. And I don't know whether or not it was on purpose. It worked as a reference in that way, and I thought it did add a little bit of that sort of wink and nod, tongue-in-cheek humor that I liked from the Saul stuff in Breaking Bad.
And I really love the sad balding that he's going through.
Yes, plus the mustache.
Like, plus, yeah, just the worst mustache. Like, it looked like a fake mustache he would have in Mr. Show. So I really enjoyed that,
It's
too.
Also worth noting that there's a bit in this where he's doing something at the Cinnabon, and there's a guy he's making eye contact with who looks like he's staring him down, and he walks up. And it turns out the guy is going to see someone on the other, like, out in the entrance. Yes, a girl, but there's some other people around there. And
but
gives
it's
a hug.
Crazy because the look he gives looks like he was
like
exactly.
a total big beefed looks out meth head exactly, looking guy.
Exactly. And there's something nice knowing that Saul, while he got away with as much as he did, like, he still lives
he's still
every
watching
day
his ass.
Looking over his shoulder.
Yeah, he really does. I really did enjoy, though, like, that is a specific kind of person who looks at his woman like he wants to take him apart from across the
Yeah, that's a...
Because when you see the way that guy looks, I'm like, oh, yeah, that guy probably would look at his girl that way.
He has the same facial expression Henry Rollins has all the time.
Yeah, he really does. And then we kind of cut into the episode, and this is Saul just down and out, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he gets paid $700. He thinks he's going to get paid $2,100, maybe. Maybe that was him trying to scam his way into $2,100. But he's defending some teenagers who, let's see. Well, Zach called it out as we're just seeing the video, but we can't actually see what's on the video.
What tipped me off is there's a moment where they say, yeah, now cut through the neck.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, no. And it's his three clients, these three teenagers, they snuck into a morgue, and they are severing a head off a body.
And then we find out later that they then fucked that head.
Yes.
It's such a great first case.
Yeah, so this is the type of black comedy we're starting out with. This is where we're starting. The teenagers fucking the severed head actually feels very akin, and I don't want to constantly draw Breaking Bad parallels with this show, because I do want to let it be its own thing, but it reminded me of the first time we saw the acid that they broke down the bodies with cutting through the tub, and you have, like, the body mulch everywhere. It's the similar level of, like, oh, this is the kind of fucked up we're starting the road with. Like, yeah. This is the level of gore we're comfortable people, for the first time they may be seeing the show, this is what we're comfortable with them being their welcome.
And then, so he's going by the name Jimmy McGill,
Jimmy
right?
McGill, yes. Yeah.
And he's got a... did we establish if it was
his brother?
Or not?
Yeah,
Chuck is his brother, yeah.
Yeah, so it's played by Michael McKean, who's really good in this.
Very
like,
good.
Plays... kind of a quack in a way. I mean, like, dude doesn't believe in anything electromagnetic.
Yeah, he has to leave your phone and leave your phone in the mailbox, yourself.
And I feel like there's some sort of implication that, like, he feels like it's going to help with his health situation, and we don't know the specifics of his health situation. We just know he has one.
He's writing the paper on electromagnetism on an old school typewriter.
Yeah, I assume that he's just not mentally healthy.
Yes.
I can't help but feel, especially because Saul's trying to help him with the case, and he seems to be undermining himself during it. So, yeah, and Saul's basically trying to get him to settle for this $26,000 check, and he won't do it.
No, he's trying to get him
paid.
He's
trying to get $17
million. No. So this is what I pull from watching it. He's fighting the fight, the good fight,
right,
in the room with everybody for $17 million. But when he goes back to talk to his brother, he doesn't believe he's going to get the $17 million. He thinks he has to take the check.
Right.
And that's what he's trying to convince his brother, is that you have to take this check. Like, we're piss poor broke.
No, he's trying to convince his brother to like, take legal action against the firm.
Oh, is that what
it is? They want him to divest his shares. That's what Saul wants him to do. Okay. Jimmy, I should say.
And he doesn't have electricity, so he's like... He's got a cooler that he's keeping everything in for a fridge. And
yeah.
Sells to something like, will you quit having me buy bacon? It's like a tricky...
Trichinosis.
Trichinosis stew. I love that. Yeah, I don't know how much more specifics we should get into, unless you guys have a particular thing, but maybe Tuco?
Yeah, Tuco's what I want to talk about.
Tuco's at the end of the episode.
The other thing I called, Zach, I successfully totally called two things in this episode. I was so proud of myself. As soon as we saw the Mexican grandmother, I was like, oh, this has to be related to Tuco.
To which I'm thinking right away, like, are we going to see Hector?
Oh, man.
Like, pre-Bell Hector?
Can you imagine?
If we do see Hector, then that means that Gus Fring isn't a thing yet.
Yes.
You know what? Well, he is, but he's not to the level that he is in Breaking Bad because
right. He'd
we
be early
saw
on
that
his
episode
career.
Where he basically caused Hector to be the way that he is, right?
Yes.
Through poisoning him?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting to think about. What was the other? There was another tie-in I was trying to think of.
The nail salon? And
that,
Mike.
That too. Yeah, Mike. Yeah,
pops
Mike,
up briefly.
Herman Trout. Now, I've read that they actually do an entire episode where they explain how Mike got to where he is.
Yes.
Which I'm really looking forward to.
I'm
that.
Under
what
the,
a great choice to put him as
so
like a
perfect.
Cast member.
And he is a season regular, so we can expect him to pop up in most episodes, which is nice.
Yeah, I feel like there was three supporting characters in Breaking Bad that when I watched, I just wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the guy who played Gus Fring. Like, he was just so good in that.
Good.
And, like, he had to die when he died, but, man, that character was so good. He was so good at playing.
Guess what?
Him.
He's in Community, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's awesome in it.
And then Mike Ehrmantraut and Saul Goodman.
And here we got
in reverse order of what I just said is how much I love them, so.
So this show's working out perfectly for you, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, yeah. And then Hector was, like, a distant fourth from those ones, so I figure we gotta see Hector at this point.
I have a feeling we will somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
And I think it's, now that we know Tuco's involved, I think it's a safe bet to say sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I'm thinking so. I like that he had no ties to Tuco in the show.
What would you do if the second episode is just building up to Tuco killing Saul, and it turns out that this is like an alternate universe? Just
oh,
a two-episode
yeah,
series, and that's it.
And Saul takes out Tuco.
Or even the other way around. Whichever. I just think it'd be hilarious if, like, oh, yeah, by the way, early April Fools, this is a two-episode series.
I would be mad at first, and then I would probably laugh a lot.
You'd grow to
appreciate
it.
You guys got me. You guys got me.
For real, though, I know you film more.
There's been all kinds of reports.
So this is something I found interesting. The first five episodes of the season, they're the only five we have titles for. Every episode ends in O.
Really?
Yeah. So the pilot is called Uno. The second episode is Mijo. Then Nacho, Hero, Jello are the first five episodes.
Interesting.
And I'm wondering, now we know that the Breaking Bad writers like to do stuff, weird things with the titles.
Yes.
So it would not surprise me if this was a...
From at least the second season on,
yeah.
There was always a theme with the titles.
Absolutely. So it would not surprise me to see every episode end in an O this season, which is one of those things that might only be interesting to me, but I find it interesting. So.
It's interesting to the entire internet.
Okay, good. Because internet, we need to work together and try to derive some sort of meaning out of this.
All right, well, I'm gonna cast the first stone then. I think that the presence of O somehow means oxygen, and somehow oxygen's gonna come into play in this.
As if it's the very thing keeping him alive.
Like Hector. Right?
That is like
Hector's
Hector.
On oxygen, as I recall.
Another thing that I thought was really interesting about this episode is, in Breaking Bad, they like to do a lot of really tight close-ups on Cranston's face. And in this, they tended to like to shoot Odenkirk more from further out and from wider angles, which I think sort of belies the tone of the show in an interesting way, wherein, like, those close-ups on Cranston, you would get to see the sweat dripping down or, like, the little twitches of his muscles. Meanwhile, shooting Odenkirk from afar and wide angle as much as they did gave a sense of him being very small and overwhelmed compared to the world he's in.
Yeah, I kind of read it as he's a little bit overwhelmed in this show. Like, everything he does, it's a bit of the Indiana Jones kind of thing in that, like, everything he does
piles on.
Other shit happens that he can't control, which happened with Walter White to a degree, but Walter White was able to control his destiny quite a bit.
Yes.
Saul seems completely unable to.
Is at the whims of the world.
Another thing with the Cinnabon thing, so I made the observation when we were watching, he has a pretty nice house for working at a Cinnabon, so you can't feel too bad for Saul.
No, he's doing okay.
Yeah.
You can tell he was prepared that might happen.
He's definitely prepared to manage a Cinnabon.
Yes, he is overqualified.
Do we got any more observations about the show, or should we move on?
I think we ought to move on.
Okay.
Goodbye, skateboarders.
So this is usually the part where I'd review some Oscar movies. I didn't watch a one this week. You know why? Because I don't want to slash my wrist. That's why. I want to live. Shit is depressing.
It is dark.
We covered that a lot last episode. But yeah, that's next week. I promise I'll have at least one thing to review. But this week, no. I had to take a break before we hit the home stretch.
Yeah, necessary.
And I've seen most of them. For the major awards, I think there's one movie I have to watch still for, like, supporting actress or actress. There's, like, one movie left. So, you know, I'm almost there, guys. I don't think I'm going to do what I did last year where I saw, like, every available one, period.
Yeah.
I just don't have the stamina this year. I don't have the
time. Especially in this kind of year.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's a bummer. So, I gotta wench it back a little bit.
Smart. Yeah.
Anyway,
Before I came here today, I watched a 30 for 30 that debuted today.
Oh yeah,
Called Of Miracles and Men, and it basically covered the Soviet hockey teams.
Oh, I heard
and
about this.
The Miracle on Ice from the Soviet perspective, and it's. I mean, the Miracle on Ice game is my favorite sporting event of all time. Like, to me, that's the best game of anything that's ever been played. And I'm fascinated by those Soviet teams. And so I'll watch any documentary, I'll read any book about them. And this is a really great one, especially for how much focus it put on sort of the building of the Soviet program and the two main coaches who sort of led the Soviet mastery over the game, which were Anatoly Tarasov and Viktor Tikhonov. And Anatoly Tarasov was the first coach of the team. And he was not a hockey man at all. In fact, when they first started the program, hockey was barely played in Russia. And he was very poetic in the way he viewed the game. He didn't try to do what the Canadians did and match what they did. He sort of created his own style of hockey. But he truly believed that the foundation of every great sports team should be love. Like, they should love one another. They should love the coach should love them, they should be a family looking out for one another, and that would make them unbreakable. And for a long time they were, until eventually Tarasov was fired. And there was one coach in between, and then Viktor Tikhonov took over, and he's sort of where the Soviet hockey team that most people know was reborn, and that he was hyper meticulous. He had these crazy ass notebooks, and he kept a stopwatch to measure, like, to the second exactly what everybody was doing.
So he was like Belichick?
Worse. Way crazier than Belichick.
Okay.
Because, like, not as...
So he's like Walsh then.
Not as grumpy or aggressive, but way, like, as meticulous, if not more, than Belichick.
So he probably read Bill Walsh's book like everybody else did.
You know, I get the sense, like many Russians at the time, he was not a fan of Americans and would not be taking advice from them.
I don't know.
But it does do a great job of sort of... It's actually something I thought I loved about Whiplash, is it does a great job of sort of showing these polar opposite views of motivation and how and what their effects were on the Soviet team, similar to how Whiplash focused in on that hyper-testosterone, aggressive form of motivation that was much more Tikhonov's bailiwick.
Yeah, I think that going away from the hyper-aggression in sports didn't really happen until the 2000s.
No. But for Anatoly Tarasov, that's where the Russian
because
hockey team
player
started.
Because player-coach used to be a real thing.
Yes.
Like Rick Adelman, for example, with the Blazers. Like, he's known as a player-coach because he didn't hit his players in practice. that was a rare thing to see.
It's weird how American sports and Russian sports took opposite directions on that. It's very strange. I don't know. I'm fascinated by the Russians. I really am. I could watch shit about the Soviets all day long.
Oh, you should watch The Other Dream Team then.
I will do that.
I watched this not too long ago. It talks about the Lithuanian... And we've talked about this a little bit on Skies, but I don't think I talked about this documentary. Move Me to Tears. Like, actually Move Me to Tears. It was. It covers the Lithuanian team that got the bronze medal in 1992. The year the Dream Team won. And they wound up beating Russia to get the bronze medal. But pretty much all the players on Lithuania used to be all the players for the Russian gold medalists in, like, 88 and just, and you know, 84. Like, a bunch of them were in that Olympic team. Like, Arvydas Sabonis is probably the most famous one.
Yeah.
There's a couple other NBA players that were there. Saronis Marcellonis comes to mind, who played for the Warriors for a while. But it is incredible when you watch that. And, like, in Lithuania, basketball is really big. And then they just got rolled over by Russian one day. And they're like, well, now you're playing for the Russians. And they didn't want to, but they wanted to play basketball too.
Yeah.
And it was just like, there's two moments of Movement of Tears. One is when they actually go to the U.S. for the first time. They're being constantly watched that they can't defect. But, like, they're seeing how much freedom everybody has. And they're smuggling back shit. Every one of them is, like, smuggling back things to make a, you know, to actually make some money when they go back to Russia. And the other is when Russia actually, like, when they actually break off of Russia, like, pretty close to the Olympics. And so Lithuania just barely squeaked in there. And then they beat Russia. And it was just, like, it's so amazing to hear them talk about that, you know. But it's a really good documentary. That's another one you can catch on Netflix.
Watch sports documentaries, people.
Yeah, they are very moving. I don't think you have to even like sports for a lot of sports documentaries.
Sports are inherently dramatic, which is why they work so well for documentary and film.
Yeah, like the best sports documentary I've ever seen was they did one where it was When We Were Kings.
Oh, yeah.
So this guy, like, filmed Muhammad Ali facing George Foreman and the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire.
I saw that. That was really good.
Yeah, and I think it took him like 27 years or something to put the movie out. Like, I don't know all the complications he hit, but it took a long, long time before the movie came out. And it is incredible. And you, to add to it, the music is so good because they used all the bands that played in Zaire. Like, they had James Brown and fucking just every big R&B artist who was black in the 70s was in Zaire for this fight and did a giant concert. And it's just, like, incredible. Just, and you can see why everybody rallied behind Muhammad Ali in there. Like, George Foreman went there and he wanted nothing to do with anybody there and was just about crushing Ali. And he had just crushed Frazier, so everybody assumed because Frazier had beat Ali that he was just going to roll over Muhammad Ali. But Ali was like, he was like doing chants with them all the time and like trying to pick up customs that they had around Zaire. Like, he really was like a man of the people there. And it's just like, it's such a good documentary. And by the way, there's no real villains in it because you go into it feeling like Foreman's a villain when you're watching this, because he kind of was back in those days. But they even said that loss, like, completely transformed him because he just didn't box for a couple of years and became very introspective and thought about what he was doing in life. And when he came out of it, he actually became the friendlier giant that everybody remembers now. You know, the big smiling guy who had the Doritos commercials and who sells grills. So, but I mean, that was only possible because he got defeated by Muhammad Ali. And you know, it's an incredible documentary. I really recommend that one. when we were kings.
Speaking of sports talks, have either of you seen Senna?
No. Nope. And furthermore, when I hear the term Senna, that's like, that's what they call Sennacot, which is like a laxative.
Yeah.
So
yeah, this is Senna, S-E-N-N-A.
Yeah. Yep. His, same thing as a laxative.
It's about a Brazilian Formula One racer named Ayrton Senna.
Oh, that's on Netflix.
It's really
good. I've seen that a lot.
It's really, it's one of them. I don't like car racing at all.
It looks like I'm not a car guy. Kill Bill a little bit from the cover.
Oh, yeah. It's nothing like Kill Bill.
No, I know, but it's like the yellow that is a Kill Bill that wearing a similar suit to what Uma Thurman wears in there. Yeah.
It's, well, the thing that makes this documentary so interesting is there's no interviews and no commentary. It's entirely archival footage and home videos from his family. Like, that's all the content in the movie.
Okay, so what did he do?
He won 3 Formula One championships, and then he died at 34 in a race. So it covers his entire career from his debut till his death, and then a little bit about his legacy, which was a lot in safety improvements for the cars. But it also focuses on his rivalry with another driver, Prost, I think his name was. It's very good. If people liked the movie Rush, it's right along those lines, and I thought it was much more captivating than Rush.
Is that the bike riding one?
No, that's Premium Rush. Oh. Rush is the one with Thor as the car driver.
Oh,
yeah.
I haven't seen it.
But I mean, I don't like racing sports at all. I don't watch them. I have no interest in them. I know nothing about cars. But this documentary sucks you right in. He's such a magnetic central figure, and the way everything is sort of laid out and portrayed is so engrossing that you get sucked right in, and you become something of a racing fan for like the 90 minutes you're watching the movie.
And he died at 34?
34, yeah. 30, I'm pretty sure 34. He's either 33 or 34.
That is young, that's said the 36-year-old.
Really the freshly 36-year-old. Yeah.
So lay some wisdom on us, dude. Like, what's a good sports documentary we should check out?
You know, I don't have a lot of them that I've watched. The last one that I watched that I really enjoyed was the 30 for 30, the one with the 83 draft.
Oh, wait a minute.
I think it's called the... Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that was
a great documentary.
That's
fascinating, especially because it covers every single team.
Yeah, and like what their move was and where they were at. Oh, God, it's so fascinating.
Yeah, like I watch it. I don't think the 49ers have a move in that draft till I watch, and it's like they almost traded Montana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy shit, dude. That plays in that Walsh thing I was talking about earlier about never being happy.
Uh-huh.
They almost traded away the greatest quarterback of all time.
Arguably.
Or Super Bowls without cheating, Zach. That's pretty good.
Well, it is worth noting that team did get in trouble for salary cap issues.
No, and
that
Jerry Rice
no. That was
admitted
to
using Stick'Em. But
that was, yeah, and
that
the Stick'Em.
That was the 95 49ers on both fronts.
Gotcha.
That was the Steve Young-led team. Joe Montana, flawless. See, I was ready for that. I got my defenses up. I was all ready for it before I said it.
Not the best thing about the Elway to Marino, but one of the most interesting things is they take a full bit of that movie just to diverge and talk about Jim Kelly hating Buffalo at first, which I thought was great.
Going to the USFL. Just like, fuck this.
Everything in that is fascinating. Every decision anybody made was
incredible. The Rooneys just like lamenting, like, why didn't we get Marino?
Oh my God.
Do you want to lamenting? He went, what, 30th in that draft?
It was 20-something, I'm pretty sure.
Like 29, 30. Yeah, it was close to the end.
I thought it was all but one team. So however many were in those days. I don't know how many expansion teams have happened since that time, but...
At least two, right? At least.
Definitely two. I mean, the Panthers and the Jaguars.
Well,
for
then the Texans were in, like, what, 2000? Oh, yeah,
but they were the Oilers.
Right. No. The Oilers are now the
Oilers are the
Titans.
No,
not the Ravens. The
Oilers are the Titans.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right.
So they had probably, the expansion like, probably draft been, like, that. Four teams since then. So it was, like, 27 teams.
Yeah,
that you
some,
see.
27,
so I would say that 25 teams lamented. No, 24 teams lamented not grabbing Marino.
Yep.
Because I would say the Niners didn't ultimately. Even though they had a play to make it, and I doubt that the Broncos felt bad about it, yeah. And I think everybody else felt horrible about it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, like even the Colts, they probably could have grabbed Marino and not dealt with all the drama behind it.
And put it aside them.
Yeah. But it was like all the rumors going around about the marijuana use that Marino
That's
had.
So ridiculous when you look at it now. I mean, but I do feel like if that same thing happened, the same thing might happen with him.
Oh, 100%.
Like, that's weird that that hasn't changed anybody's outlook.
But, looking at it now, though, I mean, this last draft with Johnny Manziel, like, all the off-field stuff that he'd been through, and recently, like, what was it, Monday, he went into rehab.
By the way, when I saw that headline, I was terrified. Because when all I saw was NFL star goes to rehab, and I was sure it was Gronk. I was positive it was Gronk.
I was reading some Onion sports articles the other day. I think I posted one to you.
Yeah.
I don't remember which one I posted to you, but they had one that said it was a testimonial by this guy in a bar who says, like, I drank with Gronk 15 minutes before kickoff. And they said, like, they said he's currently pushed in a police cruiser, and it's like 5 minutes before kickoff that the article was written. Which one did I throw to you? Do you remember?
The one you had was, God hates Russell Wilson.
Yeah,
that's a great one.
Yeah, it was literally God talking about fuck Russell Wilson was his quote. But he said, yeah, I only had that miraculous catch so it hurt more when the prick lost the game.
That one made me so happy. Because we all know God is not on the same side as Belichick. Belichick might be the Antichrist.
Well, then he also... Yeah, they had another article I thought about posting to you, but I was like, I had to pick which one. I thought the Russell Wilson one was funnier. But they also had one that said Belichick gives thanks to his God. Yeah. Like, he has a dark God that he, like, gave thanks to.
Well, I also saw one. It was... Belichick cries tears of tar after winning.
That was just a photo. Yeah.
I love it.
They had another one that really made me laugh. And, like, it's not a great written article, but it's a great idea. Which is, it says, fans everywhere brace for picture of Brady with the trophy. And it has, like, all these people that are bitching about how they're going to have to open up their web browser and quickly scroll down so that they don't see Tom Brady holding his fourth Super Bowl trophy. I thought that was really funny.
Oh,
too.
I love it so much.
I also saw a picture that was a post-coital picture somebody put up. Some girl put up
of Julian Edelman.
Of Julian Edelman.
That was great. It's basically a Snapchat of her with Edelman passed out in bed behind her. And it just says, I totally fucked Julian Edelman last night.
Is that real?
That's real.
I heard
real.
About that, yeah.
And at a Bruins game yesterday, they had Gronk come out to spike the puck for the opening face.
That too. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, everything's a meme now. Everything's a meme now.
That's true.
Oh, I love being the champion so much.
What's it like? I don't remember. It's been since 1995 since I had that feeling.
Remember?
And I didn't appreciate it enough.
Because that's how I feel.
I was 16 years old. I didn't appreciate it enough.
That's how I was for the early Pat Super Bowls, because I was in middle school for those, grade school and middle school. I was in high school for the 07 season. I was out of high school for the 11 season. So then that's why this one, I learned to appreciate it properly.
You want to know what's really obnoxious about that? Is that I felt so entitled that, like, I thought it was a slap in the face to me personally that it took them 5 years to
get
win a
back.
Super Bowl since I was a 49er fan.
It's easy when you're a kid to forget that winning the Super Bowl is really fucking hard.
I'd only been a fan of the team for 5 years, and they'd only won one, and I felt like that was a slap in the face that the Cowboys had already won two.
You should go back and tell your younger self to just be like, just be glad you're not rooting for the Browns, all right?
Can you please, like, get a camera and take pictures of yourself being happy? Because you may never feel it again.
You guys, we didn't even talk about it with the halftime show at the Super Bowl. A lion finally made it to the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Which, by the way, when Jacoby said that to Jalen.
When did he say it on?
Their last episode of Jacoby and Jalen.
Oh, I only listened to one out of probably every 50.
He said line in like twice. Did and he? I was like, line in? What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. I only listened to one out of probably every 10 or 12 of those. Now.
Yeah. That's the one I'm always like, do I have time to listen to this?
For me, it's like, oh, there's no other. All the other podcasts I listen to don't have a new episode. Oh, I like Jalen, and that's when I listen to it.
I go through all the sports ones at work first because I know I won't get in trouble when I listen to them, with the exception of this one that I listen to, Rip City Bad Boys. I can't listen to that one at work. I will get in trouble.
I can listen to literally whatever I want at work. I could listen to nothing but R. Kelly, and there's nothing anyone could do about it.
I support your decision. If that's what you want to do.
I stand by it. I stand by it.
So we were talking earlier. I got an autographed copy of Tusk. It's official now. There's one sitting on the bench. It's going to go up on the wall.
Yeah, it's got to join the collage.
It is. It's the first podcast movie to come out. And we talked about it so much.
Like a lot.
Yeah, so I actually paid the extra $15 to get it autographed. I think that's all it was like an extra $15 to get it autographed. I'm like, all right.
Yeah, may as well.
I'll get one Kevin Smith autograph. I'm never going to meet him.
No, that's probably never going to happen.
It's probably never. If it does happen, it'll be so sad that like it's not even worth talking about. It'll be like 20 years after he's put out a movie.
Well,
he'll be sadly signing copies of Cacophony to like super diehard fans that are 60.
As long as he keeps kicking his hockey thing down the road a little bit in time for me to make it an audition for it, that's your best shot.
Is he still going to do that? Because I almost felt like once Goon came out, he almost gave that idea up.
Well, the last I heard is after Goon, he talked about retooling it as a mini series, which I think would be much more interesting.
I do know he's doing that Yoga Hosers movie Moose Jaws, which is Jaws with a Moose.
Which I could not be more excited. I'm way more excited for that one than Yoga Hosers.
I'm not excited for Yoga Hosers, but I'll totally check
it out. Oh, yeah, of course. Like, I'll still watch it.
A Kevin Smith movie about people behind a counter selling things.
I'm sold on that concept.
I feel like he's got a good track record there.
He can totally sell that movie.
And he is doing Clerks 3. That's confirmed.
Yep, that's happening.
Because Yoga Hosers and Moose Jaws happened because he was waiting for Clerks 3 to get approved. So. Mm-hmm. I think it's been approved.
Which is good. Those should keep him busy long enough for me to get down.
I'm interested in what Clerks 3 will be, because I actually like Clerks 2 more.
I really like Clerks 2.
Yeah.
I haven't revisited Clerks 2 in a while, but I enjoyed it when I watched it. And Rosario Dawson's in it.
Rosario Dawson is a fine, fine...
She won't be in it, though.
No.
She won't be in it because they, like, seem to bond during Clerks 2, and then, like... She was like,
I'm totally
going to work with you guys more. And then she wouldn't return any calls that he had for a bunch of movies. So, yeah, that's not happening. I'm pretty confident in that one. I don't think she's going to do any more.
And
it would be great, though, considering she was married to Dante at the end of Clerks 2.
They got engaged.
Well, here's the thing. Don't Mila Kunis and Mark Wahlberg get married at the end of Ted? And yet Mila Kunis is not in Ted 2. Amanda Seyfried is the love interest.
But Tom Brady's in Ted.
Yeah, he is. Oh, and he and Gronk are both in Entourage. I could not be more excited for this year, you guys.
I feel weird about the Entourage movie because I want to go see it. And yet I checked out on the last season. I could not get through the last season.
See, I feel weird about it because
I couldn't get through the second to last season. I don't even know what the hell happened in the last season.
I feel weird about going to see, because I want to see it. I just don't want to be seen seeing it.
It's like going into a porno theater.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have a problem with that. I was okay with Entourage. I really liked the first couple of seasons, too, where it felt like
I think every like the first movie two or three that they are were really
doing,
strong.
Yeah, every movie they were doing felt like the most important thing in the world. And I loved the way that they would build it up and all of a sudden something different would happen. Yeah. And you'd be like, oh, no.
The show just got too douchey for me. It just crossed a Rubicon with me.
I felt like when they started. Okay, so this is where me and Bill Simmons disagree, because he said that like Vincent Chase, or whoever played Vincent Chase, was such a bad actor. They got better because they concentrated on the other actors. See, I disagree. He is a bad actor, and I don't...
Yeah, we're not arguing that.
Or maybe he's good.
No, he's not.
I don't know, because the dude's a blank slate. That seems to be most big actors. But the thing is, when they started focusing on what Turtle were doing, and E, and drama, like when they became the major storylines, the storylines just weren't as good. They weren't. Like, it felt like there was a real stake in the other ones.
That's the thing, is, like, for as bad as Vincent Chase was, like, there's way more stake and interest in those stories. They're higher value. They're just, by virtue of his career choice, they're more interesting than the other guy's stories.
Yeah, and with E, it was more interesting when they were taking the angle of, this guy shouldn't really be, like, hanging on to somebody. Like, it's kind of sad, and he realizes on a certain level that it is kind of sad that he's hanging on to him. And then the other two are just, like, great comic relief. But when they started, like, just making those guys the center of the story, I was just like, I don't know.
It's not the same.
Yeah, it wasn't as good. And Ari was always fantastic. But when he stopped, like, hustling movies, it was like, what am I watching?
Yeah, it's just not as
again?
Interesting.
Yeah. But that was the thing. That was what I really loved about that show, was he was so good in that show.
That's the best work Piven's ever done.
Yeah. And Piven's great, dude. I mean, apparently a douchebag in real life.
I think Piven's very good. I've seen him be real bad in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, he's great in PCU. That's the whole reason why I liked Piven, was because I saw PCU, and then everything after that was like, oh, it's that dude from PCU.
Yep.
And eventually I figured out his name was Jeremy Piven. I even watched, like, a couple episodes of Ellen because Jeremy Piven was in them. Like, he played her brother.
That's the weirdest casting choice I've ever heard of.
They don't look anything alike.
At all.
But she let him do his fast-talking, like, sleight-of-hand kind of character, which is exactly what you want out of
Piven. Yes, that's why you hire Piven.
Yeah.
So, a show I actually, my wife got me into, and they only had one season on Netflix, was The Wahlbergers, which is it's a reality show following Mark Wahlberg's family, which was...
So is it Donnie Wahlberg and company then?
Donnie Wahlberg, Paul Wahlberg, Mark Wahlberg. And there's
the
like 10 other Wahlbergs.
Yeah, there's a shitload of them.
Like Paul, I think there's a Paul, there's a Bob.
There's a Steve for sure.
Yeah, there's a ton of them. But
Paul's the one who's like the actual muscle behind the restaurant. Like,
yeah.
That's Paul's thing, is the burgers.
Yeah, he does the burgers.
And Donnie's thing is having a couch to crash on.
And
I love that he was the first famous one. By the way, did you know that Mark Wahlberg produced Entourage?
No.
He was the executive producer in Entourage. I didn't know if you spun out or if that was a coincidence.
Well, that's got me on this track, is why I wanted to bring up Wahlberg. But the best part is, like, the whole week or week and a half since I watched this, I've been, like, every time I've seen Mark Wahlberg on TV, it's fucking Mark Wahlberg. Like, I'll be in Buffalo Wild Wings. There's, like, little kids around. And like, it's fucking Mark Wahlberg.
What does Mark Wahlberg think about that, Zach?
I just got to say, I'm happy somebody's watching the fucking show. I mean, Jesus Christ, I put so much goddamn money into that shit. At least fucking Entourage sold some goddamn merchandise. Shit, buy a fucking burger, all right? I know you're watching that shit on torrents. Come on. Fucking assholes.
I love that Donnie Wahlberg is the pathetic one, even when he's the second most famous Wahlberg.
It'd be like if Frank Stallone just completely outstripped Sly in the 90s. Like, Frank just blew up.
You know what I will say about Frank Stallone, though? Here's what people don't know about Frank Stallone. Two things, okay? First thing, wrote Eye of the Tiger. He wrote it, not Survivor. Survivor took his song and recorded it. But that was a Frank Stallone joint. That's thing number one. Number two, Frank Stallone, really funny stories about Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, absolutely.
He has an entire career on the talk show circuit.
I honestly believe that's why
brother.
He gets cast on shows like Blue Bloods. It's just like, I want to hang out and hear stories about Sly for the next 6 years of my life.
I honestly, when I picture him, I just picture him singing in Rocky because that's the only way I know what Frank Stallone looks like. And I don't want to know what he looks like.
You want
now.
Him to exist in that moment.
Yeah. I just him singing Take It Back, snapping on the streets of New York. That's all I know about Frank Stallone, the way he looks. I'm okay with it.
That's what we want from Frank.
It's an Oscar award winning film.
Thanks.
It was
shout out
picture.
To you, Frank.
Yeah, way to go,
keep
Frank.
Holding it down.
Keep telling us embarrassing stories about Sly.
Forever.
You know he hasn't been on any of his sets for a long time because of this, right? Like, he probably made like two appearances on Howard Stern, and by the second one, Sly just cut him out from every set.
Yep, Sly's like, when I make Don't Stop and My Mom Will Shoot Too, you don't get to come visit, Frankie.
It doesn't matter because he's got them all banked.
That's right. And Frank's like, that's fine. I'm going to live off my Eye of the Tiger royalty check. That's it. Yeah. Frank doesn't have to work again.
That's true. That's probably true. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would imagine just off of Eye of the Tiger, he does well.
Oh, yeah.
That movie, or that song is still like...
gigantic.
Yeah.
Especially in ad campaigns and other movies. Like, it's going to be around forever.
Yeah, just off of Rocky III, it'll make him a good check for the rest of his life. And it deserves to be. It's a great song.
It really is a great
off
song.
Off of a great movie. Rocky
with
III.
The best homoerotic beach hug you'll see in any movie.
Dude, I'm going to go with best homoerotic moment in a movie.
I don't know. The Top Gun. You haven't seen the Top Gun volleyball.
I have seen it. I haven't watched Top Gun.
You haven't seen it in context.
Exactly. It's even more homoerotic with all the brotherly love built into it.
There's a pilot to his captain. You have to have that bromance there.
I got one question for you. Are there any half shirts in that scene?
I'm pretty sure everybody's shirtless for the most
part. Yeah, it's...
That's not...
Half shirt is good, but no shirt's better.
Especially because they're all greased up.
Half greased up, half shirt is the ultimate, and that is Rocky III. Come on, you know I'm being honest.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
Half shirt is way more homoerotic.
Just by
than
the
no
factor
shirt.
Of the numbers involved in beach volleyball. Just by sheer volume of man
How about
muscle.
The fact that it's literally just two men embracing on a beach? Who beat each other up and then, like, love each other.
Again, you're describing both movies right now.
But one of them has half shirts, I'm just saying.
I don't know where to go from that. How do you segue out of that?
I think we just end it, probably.
Take it easy, folks.
Shirt's better than half shirt.
Oh, respect the outro.